Welcome back to Sparkwood in 21. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
If you like what you hear, head on over to noship.net where you can find all of the other podcasts we do. If you like horror, we have Penny Dreadful and Ash vs. Evil Dead. If you like historical, we have Vikings and Spartacus. And we have All Flesh, the Handmaid's Tale podcast, and Shadowcast, our coverage of American Gods.
And for those who are new to our podcast, we produce two podcasts per week covering Twin Peaks. We always have the recap and our speculation based on that recap. And then we follow up with a release of a podcast on Fridays that are covering listener email. And as a reminder, please keep your emails about 2 to 3 paragraphs at the most. We want to allow everybody to get a chance to have their say. And we don't want to edit any letters. So we want to make sure that you're able to make your point that you want to make. So we're going to go ahead and get into recap. We are discussing Twin Peaks, The Return, Part 11, There's Fire Where You Are Going. And this, of course, is directed by David Lynch and written by David Lynch and Mark Frost. And we open up with three boys playing catch near a street. The ball rolls away and they discover a bloody Miriam crawling in the brush. I was immediately distressed seeing the kids playing. I was fearing for their lives.
Yeah, whenever one of them went to go chase the ball, I'm thinking there's going to be a car that's going to come around the corner. Maybe Richard Horn is still driving out of town and he's got, you know, he's got some more mayhem to deal out to Twin Peaks before he leaves.
Pennywise is going to come out of a drain.
Yeah, Dirty Woodsman, somebody.
So she's alive, just barely, and so the... It didn't blow up. Richard's stupid plan to blow up her trailer didn't work, which we knew it wouldn't. It was dumb. So
it was dumb.
Now she's going to be able to sing like a canary.
If she's not addled, yeah.
Yeah,
she could be in the state that like Ronette Pulaski was in, so where she's ends up being unconscious for a while and unable to communicate.
True, yeah.
Let's hope not, so we can get rid of this D-bag, you know? Hopefully they just send them right up the river.
What do we got? 7 left?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's all that Game of Thrones has given us for this whole, you know, year.
Yeah.
So a lot can happen in 7-plus hours, especially if the last episode's going to be 2 hours long, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we actually have 8 hours worth, give or take, worth of television ahead of it.
The final 2 hours are going to be aired.
Oh, okay. So the final episode's not going to be a 2-hour episode. It's just going to air the final 2 episodes at once.
Back to back?
I see. Right. Okay. So we really only have... All right. So we do only have 7 hours left.
So I think this is probably in the same trailer park that she lives in. So she probably didn't get very far. And another thing I thought of was... David Lynch credits the story with Isabella Rossellini walking naked as Dorothy Valens in Blue Velvet to an experience he had when he was a child where he saw a woman walking naked because kids were out playing, and then she just shows up and crying and sits down. And this made me think of that childhood experience he had because it frightened him to see that. It's a shock of hidden violence that's now in the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was referencing that again, possibly. So the eldest boy tells the other two to go get their mom.
Yeah, did you just say Elvis boy?
Eldest.
Okay, all right. I thought you were making comments on his hair or something like that. Eldest makes more sense, sorry.
Hey, go get mama.
Yeah.
Go get your mama boy.
So now we see Becky at the new Fat Trout Trailer Park. So seeing the new tacked on above the sign of Fat Trout Trailer Park was... I thought considerate, and it's showing that they do have concern about the accuracy and the attentiveness that fans have toward the show as well.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, that everything was in the can. It was already shot, produced, ready to go before they even showed us scene one. But it almost feels like they felt like the zeitgeist of it all, and they were like, okay, let's just throw them a bone here and be like, this is the new Fat Trout Trailer Park. We're going to give them a little sign. See, we do care.
Or it's like, we know you noticed that it moved and you're wondering, what does that all mean? Well, anyway.
It needs to be there. And I'm glad it is, because Fat Trout Trailer Park has always been in the big scheme of Twin Peaks, not Twin Peaks. It's only been in Fire Walk With Me. It was adjacent to the town of Deer Meadow, right? Mm-hmm. So now It's very familiar with Twin Peaks. It's actually, I would say, within the city limits of it. Carl is now familiar with, you know, Shelley. He's familiar with her daughter and her husband. Mm-hmm. He knows these people. He goes into town on a daily basis to sit on a park bench and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes.
And he can casually call the police department on a CB radio and not get any gruff from them. So, yeah, he's very much interworked into the social.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I didn't even think of that. I mean, he's probably Miriam's weed hookup. That's why. That's what I'm thinking.
Miriam?
Not Miriam. Maggie.
Okay, Maggie.
The dispatcher. The one who's doing Lucy's actual job, you know, that she should be doing. But
so now back with Becky. And she's in the midst of a phone call. And it's informing her something about Steven. And she says, "What? Damn it. I don't have a fucking car." And then she screams in peak frustration. And at first, I thought maybe he was in a dire situation. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe he's encountered Red or Richard Horn or something, or I didn't know what.
Or he got in an accident or something. She needed to be there for some reason or another.
So she immediately calls Shelley at the Double R without giving her any explanation as to why. She just says she needs her car for Steven, saying it's Steven. Like, that's the only explanation she can give, which I know if it was my parents would be like, "I don't care that it's Steven. What do you need the car for? I'm not going to just leave my job."
What did Steven do this time?
Let's go ahead and give us some info. It's for Steven.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Mine wouldn't have helped either. I understand.
But, you know, Shelley, worried, leaves in a hurry. And then this is when we see Becky pulls a gun out from under her couch. And this is when I went from thinking, oh, he was in an emergency situation where he's bleeding out somewhere, to where, oh, he's like encountered Red or Richard Horn or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was some kind of drug problem.
Yeah, that's what I went to first in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Before Becky comes out of the house to meet Shelley, there's a blurred shot, I think, of Becky.
Mm.
It's like the camera purposely blurred on her for a second.
Huh.
It seems like this happens. You see it happen one other time in this episode. I think it's Bill Hastings. There's something that happens right before he gets taken out in the backseat of the cop car.
Yeah.
And his face does that same thing. It shifts a little bit, and I feel like that's an indicator that there's something going on. Something is moving through the dimensions in front of that person, or around that person, or through that person, possibly,
or affecting them.
Oh, yeah, some
kind of energy is being sent through.
Right. Almost like when there's waves of heat in front of something, and it starts to produce mirages or whatever else. You know, you could see something there that's not normally visible, and I think that's what happened with her. That's what had happened. When we saw Mr. C shoot Hastings' wife, and then you see it again with Hastings in the back of the cop car. So I don't know where it's all going or what it all means, but there's something there.
Nice.
So maybe it has to do with the woodsmen, kind of without seeing them, but they're there.
Yeah, like that's feeding what they off give that off energy.
Shelley gets out of the car. Becky takes her keys and then takes off with the car with Shelley on the hood. And Becky peels out backwards, which she starts to fling the car around. And this causes Shelley to fly off, hit the ground, shoes flying. That was stressful.
That was probably one of the more stressful parts to watch, not just in this episode, but maybe the whole season so far, because I honestly felt like they were going to do Shelley in at that point. Like, she was going to fly off the car, hit the side of a trailer or another vehicle, and bash her head in and just be dead. And
it was shocking. No. It was like mouth open shocking as it's happening. It's like, and the way that they kind of filmed it, it felt realistic, you know, because they show it from the inside and the way, and she's got one hell of a grip. Shelly's got some guns, because I thought she was going off the first time, made it all the way around, and then got thrown off. So, I mean, it was really well done.
Yeah, I did worry for Shelly, too, because, in fact, I think when she was leaving the Double R, I was like, nothing better happen to Shelly, damn it. I think I said it out loud.
You did. Yeah, you did.
So Amanda Seyfried did a great job.
Oh, man. Oh, she was excellent. She totally sold that anger. When you get that pissed and you have that kind of impotent rage and you just can't do anything about it and you're just so upset. I think we've all been there. She just started pulling her hair out.
So Carl Rod comes over to investigate, and he discovers Shelley, and Shelley asks for a ride to the Double R, and he blows a whistle to summon his Volkswagen limo service.
Tell me you didn't think of Willy Wonka when he did this, right? Calling some Oompa Loompas to come pick him up. I mean, it was awesome. I was like, he just fluted a car to him.
And that guy was there within seconds.
Dude,
like, he's just sitting
go.
Behind the wheel of that VW bus, just, you know, playing chess on his phone or whatever. Or maybe he doesn't even have a cell phone. Maybe that's why he uses the flute whistle, because he just that's all that guy can hear is that high of a register.
I absolutely loved it. It made the episode for me. I was like, that is unexpected. That's as unexpected as Shelley riding the top of the car. He's a badass. I want to flute a car to me. You know, I want a police CB in my car, even though I would never use it, but I would still like to have it. Yeah. I mean, he even had a setup to where he had his smokes and a glass. It looked like a glass of wine or something, or a drink or something on top of it.
Had an ashtray.
It's quite a nice setup. And she tells him, can we go any faster? And he's like, I want to get us there all in one piece. So he's really self-conscious about, like, being good and, you know, doing the right thing. So, yeah, I think it's awesome.
He's also had 6 DUIs and he legally can't drive. That's why he has to have a chauffeur.
And he doesn't use a cell phone because he uses his whistle.
It's better to blow that whistle than to blow your steering wheel into service.
Yeah, interlock.
I don't know. I mean, it's pretty awesome.
Shelley calls Norma. Norma asks, why hasn't she called Bobby? And that's when you're like, yes, Bobby's her dad. And then Carl calls the department asking for Bobby Briggs, saying that Shelley Briggs needs to speak to him. We're like, oh my gosh, Briggs is her last name.
Revelation after revelation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's more disappointing because they're not still together, but I have a theory on that later.
So now Becky has entered an apartment building and she's standing before room 208. She screams and bangs at the door with the gun, and the neighbor comes out to inform her that they have left, that they just left. Becky shoots through the door in frustration after the neighbor.
Becky's crazy.
I'm not going to lie. I might have shot the neighbor. Because she was just like, yeah, I mean, I understand. I'm intruding in her privacy and tranquility. And she's just like, they're not here. Get out of here. But she just keeps going like, they left. They're gone. They're not here. Even after she shuts the door and is walking into the apartment, the temptation would have been too much.
I would have just shaken it at her.
What?
Get the fuck inside.
Keep going.
Yeah, Becky's crazy, though, for shooting through the door, because I was like, what if they're listening on the other side and that lady's lying? You might have just put a bullet through two people, you know?
That occurred to me, too. But I, at the time that she was shooting, I felt a little bit of vicarious release that she was probably feeling.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, you're getting rid of all that anger with bullets, you know? Mm-hmm. Fuck you, Steven.
That's what you call America.
Yep. That's how we do things here.
So the camera Ramo cams, for I don't know what another way to call it, were, because I don't know a lot of technical terms, but that's because we cover Ash versus Evil Dead, so that's what I'm calling it.
Made me feel like Ash versus the Evil Dead. I was like, sweet, here comes the Deadites.
Woo! It's just missing the noise.
So it Ramo cams through the hallway and it goes down a stairwell, and we discover that Steven is standing with Garrison Hayward. So Garrison Hayward is the youngest Hayward daughter, Donna's little sister.
Mm-hmm. She was the one who did the little piano recital for everybody.
And yeah, I remember.
With the
she have a tiara or something?
Yeah, she had a tiara and a wand and a pink little ballerina dress.
So she's grown up to like Bad Boys too?
If they're together in that way. I know this is probably up for debate, and I've been wrong about these things. She's holding on to him. He's not holding on to her.
Well, that's because this girl's upstairs with a gun. He's not going to hold on to her. He's going to try and run. I honestly think that if she came down the stairs and saw those two, he would push her down and run past her.
Or use her as a human shield as he backs up.
Because that is his side piece, I think is the term they use nowadays. So there's no love. It's lust. If that's what's going on. I think it is.
They're definitely banging. The mystery here is not the age difference between Gersten and Steven, but the fact that Steven was able to be married to somebody as good looking as Becky and have a, quote, side piece as good looking as Gersten. That just doesn't – something's not flying here.
I mean, it's the way they make him look. He's intentionally looked strung out. You know what I mean? So it's good makeup. It's nothing against the actor or anything, but he does. He's got game. That's all there is to it.
And the whole hair, facial hair thing. I mean, that screams 1992.
And he has drugs. So she could be with him for the drugs.
Yeah, drugs does answer a lot of those questions. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all seen that. So
I'm wondering at the nature of their relationship. I don't necessarily buy that it's sexual. I think maybe people have seen them together. Word got to Becky. And
maybe he's just doing sparkle with her.
Possibly.
You know, that's Alia, right?
That's Alia from Dune.
Holy crap, really?
Yeah. Wait for my brother, Baron.
Yeah. That's her?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Alicia Witt.
I didn't even realize that.
Natara, I mean, she doesn't have blue eyes or, you know, the whole
Bene
Gesserit get up. So
I meet her. I'm just going to shave her head and put something on her. Okay, I see it.
I see it now.
She's been working with Lynch since she was a kid.
Right. How great was that? Start your career with David Lynch and keep working with him. Must be awful.
So now we get a quick scene where the sheriff's department, Maggie, as Steve mentioned earlier, is receiving a lot of phone calls.
I hope Maggie gets Lucy's check as well as her own. That's what
Who says Lucy gets paid at this point?
Well, she's got enough money to buy furniture off of Amazon or whatever the fuck it was. Or rooms to go. And they got Rolex. Somebody in that family's getting a check unless they're getting a bunch of money that Wally makes on the road.
They definitely have a problem, that's for sure, because it comes up again this episode about buying furniture and she doesn't know why.
So. Yeah.
So do you think all these phone calls are related to the two different events we've seen this episode, or are things just getting – because we were talking about the fever pitch from part 10, and it seems like it was just the beginning that – we're still kind of rising up this roller coaster of violence, and we haven't really quite reached the top of it yet.
I think it was for this event because she gets a call, and she's like, all right, where are you at? And she goes, okay, someone will be on their way, and then she kind of sends it out. Then it's like, okay, they're on their way. So everybody in that apartment building is like, there's gunshots. You know, please send someone over.
I had M's theory the first time I watched it. The second time I watched it, I have thinking what you're talking about, because she didn't call anybody else and say and give a different address or anything like that. So I think it's all of the people that were in that apartment building or around that apartment building. But the first time I watched it, I was like, "Oh crap, is there just a bunch of stuff that's just happening in Twin Peaks?" Because a lot actually happens inside Twin Peaks in this episode.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because we open up with Miriam crawling out of the woods. So somebody's calling for that, at least one person.
I mean, we even have a drive-by in this episode, kind of. So, or what you think is a drive-by at first glance.
Well, we'll talk about it when it gets there.
So now we're with the FBI. Bill Hastings has directed them to the site. Some of the group exits the vehicle. Bill Hastings stays in the car with Detective Mackley. Diane gets out of the car, but she decides to hang back and sit on the bumper of the car she arrived in and smoke, while Albert and Gordon walk closer over to the property along with Tammy. Albert and Gordon glimpse a woodsman as well as Bill. Doesn't Bill see it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tammy is at this point talking also to Bill, asking him specific questions about how he got onto the property and all that stuff. Gordon asks Albert, "You think there's one in there, Albert?" And Albert says, "We'll soon find out." And at first, you think he's probably talking about what they just saw, that woodsman.
Yeah.
Gordon asks Tammy to cover them as they approach. Electricity is now audible. And as Gordon gets closer, there's a blurred effect that starts to happen to him. And there's a whirl that starts to form in the sky, like a wormhole,
essentially. Absolutely.
It's a gateway that opens up.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing it kind of spin out, and I think it's kind of working its way deeper into this other dimension, and eventually you have this dark, there's no light at the end of that tunnel is what I said when I saw it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it seems to come closer, almost like it's this mass or ball of mass, but it's actually what you can see inside is becoming more and more visible.
It's almost like it's far away, and then it accordions in and flattens out.
Yeah, it's so genius the way they filmed it.
Right above you. I love the fact that that's what you're seeing from Gordon Cole's point of view, but everybody else just sees him looking up and moving his arms up and down like a crazy old man.
I know, when they pull away a distance, it's a funny, funny shot.
It's so smart, though. It's so smart that you have to be exactly on those coordinates to even see it. Otherwise, if you think about it, everybody in like a 5-mile radius would come to it. It's such a gentle and smart way to film the scene.
Yeah, gentle is a good word for that.
So that's what we're assuming that they're talking about, is that you think one's in there. And
for sure.
That vortex or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wormhole, cyclone, which, again, alludes to Wizard of Oz.
Portal.
So now the thing that now that we can see into on the other side of this wormhole, it's woodsmen on a staircase, which Gordon will later describe as being in a room. I wouldn't actually describe that as a room because I couldn't really actually see a room necessarily.
Well, technically, it would be like a foyer.
You're describing a room that has a staircase inside it. I guess that would be. Never mind. I'm belaboring this.
I think he used room for lack of a better term, but for me, it looked like the steps. It just looked like steps, and they were standing at the landing at the top of the steps. And
we're kind of just like standing, descending.
You're
fashion.
Right. Yeah, they were. Yeah. They were all on the steps, I guess, but there at least one of them in the back, towards the back, looked like there was it. You can't see it, but there's a it flattens out behind them, so it goes to wherever the steps lead to, and it made me think of like that's going to the top of the convenience store.
Yeah, the first thing I thought was actually Laura's bedroom, like that's up the steps, and then the ceiling fan would be right above there.
Oh yeah, that's really good. I like that.
And then we paused it, and you can actually see this pattern behind. Like kind of in between the topmost woodsman and Steve was immediately like, that's Annie's dress, which is also Caroline's dress from the Beyond Life and Death, the final episode of the original Twin Peaks. And I thought of the wallpaper from One Eye Jack's, which is also the wallpaper in the space that Laura enters into when she goes into the painting that was given to her by the Tremonts.
Yes.
And a lot of people online are actually pointing to that. But I'm not quite sure where if it's actually Annie / Caroline's dress or if it's actually the wallpaper. It's not real clear.
It's not, of course, intentionally. And I think it's the dress. I'm sticking with the dress because that's what struck me first. And you have to have it paused at the exact right moment. And I'm sure plenty of people who did it. Most people who are any kind of serious about Twin Peaks probably was like, all right. After the second time, they were like, all right, pause it. And what can we see? And that's what we saw. And I think it's the dress because the pattern is nowhere else on the wall.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's because I want to see it or what, but I almost can see Annie's face also above.
Like she's being held hostage by some woodsman. That's her lot in life right now.
But that would make sense. Because he does say a bunch of people showed up. So we know that for sure that it was the woodsman that showed up, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know. I kind of like the wallpaper theory because if there's a chair rail that goes up along the wall, you would only have the wallpaper at the bottom if that's the way it was designed. You know what I mean? Wouldn't we have seen her struggle or anything? Or would she just be like catatonic to where she would just be kind of like got a light hiding behind him? You know what I mean?
Well, they weren't moving themselves.
Mm-mm. No, so, that's what I mean.
Yeah, so it's like I think maybe at, like what he saw was like a frozen like moment a in time. Yeah, like a snapshot. So that's what I think.
I'm not convinced that it's Annie's face, but if I stare at it long enough, I start to see her face there.
It does look like her face. Once it's pointed out, you're like, yeah, I can see that.
It did remind me of like a family photo because I've seen people take those pictures where they're standing up on the staircase and they're all wearing like white shirts.
The tallest person has to be on the bottom, so everybody kind of evens out.
So Gordon was almost lost into this metaphysical cyclone. It's almost like this white, staticky light came down and was starting to blot him out in some sort of way, which also reminded me of a cyclone. And Albert pulls him out.
Good for Albert for having a reflex. I mean, he knew, okay, enough, and pulls him, and it's like, oh, thank God.
It's almost like Albert knew. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Albert knew the exact time to do it. Like he knew that Gordon had probably seen enough and then pulled him out. Like when at the last moment, because you don't want to do it too soon because then it's like, well, what did you see? Well, nothing. You just pulled me out of it. So, but it looked like he was about to blink out of existence there for a second.
Well, he did kind of blink out for a second, didn't he not?
Yeah, absolutely. Or for like a second. He did. Like in and out.
Yeah.
And then he grabbed him.
So how can we be certain that the Gordon that went in is the Gordon that came out based on that?
Oh, God, don't do that. No. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Well, that would be bad. Or good, depending.
His behavior doesn't seem strange or anything like that. So, and Albert says, well, I guess we found out. So they were referring to a gateway, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I get out of that.
And so this is what defines the Blue Rose case is that all of these specific gateways that they have found throughout the world.
The gateways and what comes through them is what.
So, yeah, that's, I didn't mention this when I was talking about the sky turning into a whirl pattern. You also had these black figures that were getting pulled into the whirl. Now, is it birds or was that woodsmen?
It could be woodsmen. I thought it was just to give the effect of like little bits of the other world spinning in to make that black portal in the middle. You know what I mean? So where it's not really woodsmen but, or evil, just kind of like the rip starting.
Or dark matter being pulled in or something.
Exactly. And then the rip gets bigger, so it's just pulling more and more energy into it. Because without it, you wouldn't have that cool effect of the whirlpool itself. It would just be like a clear distortion of the screen. You know what I mean? With the black going through it, you can actually see the whirlpool going around. Because I thought woodsmen too at first also, until you see down the tunnel and it's black, it's like, okay, that's just creating
that black space.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the way I took it, at least.
At first, I thought it was like a flock of birds that got caught up there. I was like, oh, man.
That would be amazing if a bunch of birds just in it.
But see, they also made a point, though, to show you from the other spectator's point of view that you can't see anything amiss if you're just looking at the sky.
Nothing. So there would be no birds.
Yeah.
But it could still be woodsmen.
Yeah, it could still be woodsmen for sure.
And if it's woodsmen, there's a shit ton of them.
Oh yeah,
thousands.
They add, subtract, multiply, and divided. So,
but if it was sucking woodsmen's in, wouldn't that one that was there get sucked in too? The one that's creeping around all hooky and kills people. Like, how would he resist it?
I don't know.
That's a good point too.
Maybe it's optional. Maybe some of them
it could be.
Some of them didn't.
He was a heavier set woodsman, so maybe he was a little more grounded.
So Albert notices that there's a body over to the side, and they walk over to it, and they determine that it's Ruth Davenport because her head is missing, and she also has coordinates that she has scrawled onto her forearm. Albert takes a pic of those coordinates. And this is when Diane witnesses that a woodsman is approaching the car that Detective Maclay and Bill Hastings are in.
And she doesn't say shit.
Yeah. Nerves of steel.
Maybe. I this is really disappointing about Diane.
But she brings it up later, which made me feel a little better that, hey, I kind of saw something. But, you know, she's like, well, maybe not, you know. So.
Yeah, that's I want to talk about that when we get to that, because that's the one thing that makes me go, okay. Maybe she's all right.
Yeah.
But as she was watching this, watching him approach the car and not doing anything, it's like, oh, man, she's bad to the bone.
Yeah.
Like, who wouldn't say something about that? I mean, you're sitting there smoking a cigarette and you see that and you're not going to go, hey, Maclay, right behind you, there's some dude that's about to creep into the back of the car, you know, and whether or not he could do anything about it's another story.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, the guy's literally crouching, so he isn't seen by others as he approaches the car.
And he disappears.
Yeah.
You know.
Maybe she's pissed because the woodsman looked at her and said, fuck you, Diane.
Maybe they didn't. They looked at her and were like, well, she's definitely got a light, so I better get in this car because she smokes.
So maybe she didn't believe what she was seeing either.
Yeah, that crossed my mind too, that it's possible that she was just kind of like, I can't be white. I can't see that. And then when it disappears, it affirms it.
Or she has the same amount of knowledge that Gordon and them have also. So she kind of knows about these things because they saw that one and didn't really think anything of it either. Yeah. Granted, they thought it was a bit of a homeless person, so that could have been it. So I take that back. I take that back. She should have said something. I'm just trying to talk myself out of her being bad. That's all. I'm in denial. I'm like a battered spouse just trying not to believe it.
You're Becky trying to make excuses for Steven.
Exactly.
It's all right.
Exactly.
So I'm thinking Bill Hastings saw the woodsman get into the car, but because they're so mesmerizing, like it was established in part eight, you don't do anything. And so I think it was actually directly in front of him at the point that it cracked his head open, because he was staring into it.
That's why you get that interdimensional shimmer kind of thing effect that goes in front of his face.
Yeah, because when he sees the first one, he looks like, oh, this is it. I'm screwed. You know, at the beginning of the scene. So it's just sad. I was sad that he got killed.
I was too.
Yeah.
You know, and they're looking at him like, yep, he's dead.
But it's probably a better ending for him, because he probably would have gone to prison for something he didn't do for life anyway, you know?
Yeah.
Detective Maclay freaks out and calls for backup. Diane says there's no backup for this. Everybody comes running over. And as Steve said, Gordon says, he's dead.
Detective Mackley did it. That was great. He's just like, oh my God. Yeah, that's the real reaction. That's what you would be doing. Like, what the hell? So you notice when he calls for backup that they're at 2240 Sycamore. So this is the second time that we've had a Sycamore, either street or lane, come up in the return.
So in the first time was where Dougie came out.
Yeah.
That was a portal or doorway or gateway, whatever you want to call it there. There's one here. And then you got the sycamore trees in Twin Peaks.
There's the sycamore in the town I live in.
Don't hang out.
Don't hang out.
I don't know. I kind of want to go driving around looking now.
What's the significance of the sycamore really outside of Twin Peaks? Is it just this nice little callback reminder to keep us thinking about it? Or, hey, there's another coincidence, but we all remember what Agent Cooper says about coincidences, so there's that.
Right. And also Detective Mackley screaming like that, I think, is almost a foreshadowing or a compliment in some way to the lady screaming in her car at the end of the... With the little sick girl.
Yeah, well, if I was in a car, yeah, we'll get to that. I agree, though. I think it is a bit of foreshadowing for sure, because like Steve said, that's the proper reaction, other than barfing. Also, there'd been a good amount of puke if I'd been in the car with him. Just oof, have a lot of cursing, some vomit, and I might have just ran. I would have been the worst cop ever. I probably just would have ran. I just saw a guy disappear, and a guy in the back seat just got half his head taken off. I'm out, just running.
Taking off clothes as you go, you know, just crazy style.
Hands flailing.
So, I thought it was actually a pretty good effect that they did on Bill Hastings. Not only just like his head being cracked open and kind of like oozing out, but then also the fact that his head was slowly starting to tilt forward.
Wow, it was beautiful, but
very nice touch.
On the opposite end, the body didn't look right. You know what I mean? The body of
Ruth Davenport. Ruth.
Yeah, she didn't look right.
Her nipples were gone.
Yeah, yeah. It was like an androgynous body. Almost like it was CG'd.
Did look weirdly changed somehow. I can't really explain it.
Briggs's body didn't look right either the first time we see it in the bed. It was like, what is up with that body? You know, there's something wrong with it. So I don't know what the point of it was. Like, if you're gonna go so graphic with the head, why not do the same with the body? It's been out in the sun for 3 days. There should be some flies or something. They probably would have smelt that body from across the area. Yeah, it would have been foul. Interesting, though.
You're right. The body does look weird. It was. It looked like a mannequin body to me.
Yeah, yeah. Almost preserved in a weird way. Maybe because of it dying possibly in the other dimension and brought back over, or... The way it was killed, you know, like there's almost no blood around it.
Bloodless.
Should have been blood everywhere. Interesting, though. It's an interesting body, so I don't...
These are the coordinates that Mr. C wanted that are on her arm. So so it's not just any gateway he needs. He needs this specific gateway from her. We think he shot her because based on the wound that happened to Phyllis Hastings, right?
Yeah.
And then it was very similar to the wound on Ruth Davenport's head, where she was shot in the eye. I don't know. I guess he lost her body somehow.
That's the thing. Why wouldn't he have written? I mean, the guy's got a pretty amazing memory. Wouldn't he have just remembered the coordinates if he's the one? Or does one of his other people, like he sent one of his minions to do it, you know?
That's the big question, because it's like you guys just were talking about. You have the similarities between the deaths. But then if Mr. C had anything to do with it, he would have taken the coordinates then. So he wasn't there for a certain part of that.
So now we're in Twin Peaks at the Double R. Becky sits with Bobby Briggs and Shelley Briggs, and she can't seem to make up her mind about dissolving her relationship with Steven. Bobby tells her that she has to pay for that door that she shot up, and she says she's not going to pay for it. Besides, she doesn't have the money anyway. Shelley says that she'll lend the money. She'll give her the money. Bobby looks at her reproachfully, and Becky says she's not going to take any more of Shelley's money. And Bobby says that he'll lend her the money, which this seems like Bobby's probably the more disciplined parent here. But Bobby does want to help her, and he especially wants her to get out of this relationship with Steven. And he warns her that he's been resisting busting him for a while now, but he's not going to resist that anymore. If he slips up once, he's taking him in.
Mm-hmm. And he asks her, has he been hitting you? You know, and she's like, well, no. It's like,
That's when he should have busted out. Be like, if he messes up one more time, don't forget. Oh, yeah. Don't forget, I've killed a guy before.
Mm-hmm. And you can tell she doesn't go back to him for money very often because he tells her, you're going to pay me back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That I think everybody in Twin Peaks fandom right now is Team Bobby.
Yeah.
For sure. And Shelley was a bit of a disappointment this episode in the way that she acted.
Well, okay, let's get to that. Mm-hmm. Norma eyes Becky significantly, I think, and I don't know if she was doing that to try to inspire Becky to apologize about throwing her mom off the car. I don't even know if she knows about any of that, but the look that Norma gives Becky causes her to think of it, and she apologizes. And Shelley wants Becky to stay at her house. And at this point, as they're embracing, she's looking out, or she notices that Red has walked up out the window, and it's like her demeanor just changes instantly. And she's up out of the booth, running to meet him outside, kissing him, all this stuff. It's really bizarre. It's not normal behavior. Well, it's like he's put a spell on her.
Well, it's normal behavior for Shelley, though. You got to think of her track record. She likes a certain kind of guy. And I bet whenever Bobby became a police officer and became upstanding, that's when they started having problems. And I think she likes bad boys. You know, you hear people all the time go, I don't know why I keep going for this girl. I don't know why I keep going for this type of guy. You know, I just keep having problems. But
the
then
dark triad, exactly. As they're called. I agree with that. There are people who have pattern behavior in relationships and whatever. But I think she should have at least excused herself or something. And she didn't do for any sure. of that. So I find that no matter what, for who you are, that's bizarre behavior for you just to abruptly get up from an emotional moment like that, especially with your daughter. Yeah. When there was life or death like situation, your daughter just shot a gun. I don't know. It didn't seem right.
I agree with that. But then the reaction that you get from Bobby and her daughter, it's like they've seen it before. You know, they're like, they don't have like, you and I would have been like, what are you doing right now? You're going to run out there and act this way. But instead, they just kind of sit there and wait, until she comes back.
Yeah, it does seem like her reaction is like overly exuberant. Like she goes from cold to hot or hot to cold, however you want to say it, but it is indicative of her character in the way that she deals with men. And like Paul was saying, because, you know, she was with Leo, then she was with Bobby. And then like, I think you're right, Paul, about, once Bobby becomes an upstanding citizen and tries to do the right thing and say like, okay, I'm going to raise my family. We're going to do this the right way. And she's just like, well, the next bad boy in a leather jacket who came along, boop. And that's why they're not married anymore. And so who knows how long this has been happening or whatever. And she passed on that shitty trait to her daughter because look at her, you know, she's just head over heels in love / hate with this Steve guy who she's married to, who's just a walking piece of crap, you know?
Yep.
So it's like you have women who could do so much better, but they stick with these guys. And it's almost like it got passed down in a generation, you know, unfortunately. But I think as much as all of that's true, there is something up with Red, the way that she was able to just go from like 0 to 60 like that with her emotional spectrum. You know,
for
sure. To just be like, oh, there you are. And then to run out there, not say anything to the people at the table. So I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit of both. But I, from everything that we've seen of Bobby's character, he seems to be like a really good guy, you know. And the way that Becky is looking at him when Shelley's going out to see Red is very kind of like, sorry, Dad, that you have to see this kind of thing again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's the way I took it. Now, I was just as disappointed as Shelley as I was with Diane. It was just kind of like two scenes where it was like, oh, man, come on. Now, Red does have an aura about him. So I didn't even think about it until you mentioned it. And I can kind of see that now. So maybe I'm going to rewatch it before we do the feedback and definitely kind of keep that in mind because it is a little crazy. And that guy's got something about him, you know, even in the last time we saw him with the dime trick and everything else, it'll be something to think about for sure.
It's like there's two of them because there's one that seems nice and friendly and then there's the other one that's completely menacing and scary. I did think that Bobby and Becky's reaction to her seemed confused, and but it was like an I couldn't quite place exactly what their emotions were. I actually thought Bobby was kind of like regretful, because I think he might mm-hmm. still harbor emotions for her, like love her. And I think Becky, I thought Becky was just kind of taken aback that her mom just like up and left, and that's why mm-hmm. she looked the way she looked.
Could be. It could be. I mean, it fits. Like I said, I definitely got to watch it again with that in mind, because I hadn't even thought about it. And now when the gunshot goes off, I know we're about to talk about it, and he goes outside, I was like, well, that's the guy you should be with. He just ran out there with random bullets going through the building. Jeez.
Yeah, the other guy ran off down the street.
He's probably the one shooting.
Now back to Red and Shelley. They say they will see each other later at the same place that they usually meet. And she comes back into the double R, sits with Becky and Bobby. Shots are fired into the double R. Everybody ducks for cover. Bobby makes his way out, and there's a family that's in a minivan, and a kid has found a gun on the floor in the back of the van and had actually shot it. It was the father's gun. The mother didn't realize it was in there. I guess mm-hmm. she had, inadvertently kicked it back there towards the kid, and then he picked it up and shot it. And you're learning all this information as she's yelling at the father, and the father and son are dressed in the same outfit practically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And neither of them are reacting to anything. They're just kind of standing there like,
yeah,
I did it.
I mean, what did you guys make of that? Because it almost seems like the kid is looking at Bobby almost in a defiant kind of way.
Absolutely. Same thing with the father, just kind of like they're being mind controlled almost. You know, no emotion, just kind of like a defiant way. It was very odd, especially with that effing horn going off the whole time, which was just driving me nuts. Which rightfully so. It's what it's supposed to do. I knew that. You control me so much, David Lynch, and that one I understood.
I've got a theory about what this scene means, but we'll wait till we get to the end of it so we can, get all the information out first.
Okay, so, you can look at as the kid looks, I think, defiant, and the father looks unconcerned is the way I would describe him. Mother is very mm-hmm. upset, and Bobby asks her to get an identification. Deputy Jesse arrives from Big Ed's gas farm, and he's heard shots fired. And he says it in this really bizarre way. I think it's the first time we've heard Big Ed's gas farm mentioned.
Yeah, it definitely is. Because mm-hmm. we've all been waiting on pins and needles for Ed to show up, make an appearance.
Are we meant to think about it? Is there a specific reason why he has to say it like that?
I think it's just a signal that it's coming soon. Because all the Bookhouse boys are going with Hawk in them.
Oh, yeah. They should bring some extra firepower.
Yeah, right.
It would only make sense.
Because Big Ed would be one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So Bobby tells Jesse to, follow through with this family. So he's going to go Bobby's going to go attempt to deal with this honking woman. And in the end, discovers this very sick girl in the car with her.
Sick. She was undead. It was a zombie outbreak. I mean, that's some cool acting and so unexpected that I had to double take as it's going on. Like, holy shit.
When you see the kid rising up from the seat
mm-hmm.
and then the bile or whatever starts coming out of her mouth, you're just like, what the hell? And then it is zombie-like because she's like going towards Bobby. I thought she was going to projectile vomit on him.
Right. That would have been great.
Yeah. It was like her body had no weight to it or something like that. Like mm-mm. she was levitating practically out of the floorboard. I mean, she wasn't even in the seat.
Yeah. Yeah. It was all dark and she just kind of comes from the depths of the car. It was a little frightening. It really was, because it's like, what is happening? We all just right. had a nice family moment.
So here's my theory for this whole scene. When the shots don't ever actually happen, what happens is after the little family powwow at the double R, everybody goes their separate ways. Becky goes with Shelley to stay at her house, and Bobby goes and does whatever he's going to go do. And he goes home that night and he goes to sleep. And his dream starts at the shots, because this is his chance to be the man and to redeem himself. And that's why everything in this scene has a distinct dreamlike quality of it. It's almost like a hero fulfillment fantasy for Bobby. He gets to go out there and be the person who says, he flashes his badge and he says, I'm with Twin Peaks, Sheriff Department, do this, do that, blah, blah, blah. That's why the the man and the boy look just as unresponsive as bit players do in any dream that you have. They're almost just standing there, not even really reacting to anything, or even when you try to, like, they don't, it's almost like they just absorb. They don't bounce anything off of them. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
dream waves or whatever. So when Jesse comes up to him and says, "I was at Big Ed's gas farm. I heard shots." It's necessary information as to why he's entering into the dream, not an actual description of what was going on, because as we see later, the real life Jesse is trying to show Sheriff Truman his new car that he's got out in the PD parking lot. So then Bobby goes over to stop the lady who's honking the horn, and her and the kid who are being sick are just really weird shit that happens in a dream. But it also could be looked at as this is the nastiness. This is the disease that's crept into his life, into his psyche, all of everything that's happening, his failed marriage, the fact that his daughter's married to somebody who he wants to kill. All of this nastiness comes up like this sick child with puke running out of its mouth. And the honking horn is his alarm going off in the morning.
Oh, and then that's pretty cool take on that. Huh. That is a really cool take on that. Not what I came up with, but that's awesome, because that would explain the police officer being
in two spots at once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's the only thing that I can really make that thing stand on, besides it being fun.
Well, I mean, it's good. I think it's just a small town and the cop just pulled in and showed them their car, because I took it as Red goes by the double R. You know, and he's kind of like the sign of evil and chaos in this season, right? Because he's selling drugs. He's a bad person. So kind of like as he goes through the town, and how we were talking about how everything's kind of at a boiling point, that it just kind of hits at that moment. So he goes out, you know, and those two people are just as affected as everybody else seems to be in Twin Peaks. The dad and the son are just as bad, as it's like moving out from the woods with Jerry Horn. Now it's starting to get into town. You know what I mean? Like that, whatever's going on is just affecting everybody. And that girl could have had some of the sparkle. The girl and the mom are the only thing I don't know what to take of. You know what I mean? Like it was so oddball that I like your theory on that, because I honestly had no idea, other than just the town of Twin Peaks being taken over by whatever's coming out of the spot that they have to go check out, you know? It's pretty vague, but that's just how I felt while I was watching it. I really like the dream sequence because it makes more sense.
But what you're saying is Red is almost like a boat going through the waters of Twin Peaks, and in his wake, all kinds of fucked up shit happens because of the magic that he's using to...
Exactly. The magic, the drugs, everything. And he's just kind of like the catalyst, kind of like a match with gasoline. Like we know the gas has been spreading in this form because all these bad things are happening and the town seems to be at unrest. So as Red goes through, he's like the match that lights it. Yeah. And that's why this little girl gets sick for no reason. The lady's honking. A kid finds a gun in the back seat of the car. Who leaves a gun in the back seat of a car anyway? And just pulls the trigger and shoots it off and isn't crying or freaking out, because any little kid in anywhere else in America other than Twin Peaks would have been in tears thinking they might have killed someone. The police are there. It was a pretty chaotic thing to be a part of, you know? So it just made me feel like, okay, this is like the last push of the fire and wave going through and just corrupting Twin Peaks.
And he lit up Richard Horn to the point where he was a maniac, when that's the reason why he killed that kid.
Exactly. Just kind of worked him up. And it just kind of fits with Jerry and everything being outside, and there's it all kind of moving inward closer and closer. To me, what I would consider the middle of Twin Peaks would have been the sheriff's station. Like, it's all moving in to take over. And then who knows, maybe blow out into the rest of the world. That's why they have to go to that spot and seal the breach or whatever they have to do. It's just shocking, because I just started watching the show in the last 6 months, and it's such a switch from those two seasons to this one on just the way Twin Peaks feels and the things that are going on in it, you know, and it just seems to have gotten up and up and up, and now it's just kind of like popping, you know,
in your face.
We'll see. It's some pretty shocking scenes in this episode with the vortex, the head being taken off, and then this. My wife had actually come in, and she doesn't watch the show, and was just like, what the hell? And it's like, welcome to Twin Peaks. I don't know what to tell you, because I can't explain it. I think I can, but I can't.
I think that kid's sick. I think. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
That was her first time ever seeing anything of Twin Peaks.
For this season, yes. She just kind of came in and was like, what the fuck is this? It's like, why is that? That lady's really annoying and that stupid horn. It's like, yeah, that's about right. That's how you're supposed to feel. Gotcha.
It's not just supposed to annoy you, but I think it's supposed to like create that level of urgency and klaxons going off.
It's so effective, you know, because a lot of people don't do that. I wouldn't do that if I was making a show. I'd be like, what are you doing? That's annoying. Stop it. Let's put something else in there. But it's just so effective to get your energy up. You know, it's one of the things I love about the way that he filmed both of them, you know, from what we've experienced.
He does the sound design, too. He doesn't farm it out to somebody else.
Well, you know, you process information differently in different states of mind, obviously. No great revelation there. So he's putting you in that state of mind to where your hackles are raised and you're on edge. You know, it's grinding on your nerves. Nobody's favorite sound is a continually honking car horn. So then the way that you process everything that happens with Bobby's interaction with that lady and that kid is on that needles and pins kind of thing. So would be totally different without the honking of the horn. Mm-hmm. You could even make it more scarier or ominous, but it would be less urgent, I think.
Yeah.
And then when the honking horn goes away, it's replaced with her screaming, yelling. ah, over and over.
Yeah, I would have gotten out of the car. I would have gotten out of the fucking car. I'm sorry. I would have hit Bobby with the door and been like, shoot her. Shoot her! Demon spawn!
So now at the sheriff's department, as we've already alluded to, we've got Truman looking at a digital map and he's figured out where they need to be and there's no roads there where they need to get to. Hawk has his own map. It's an ancient map, but it's always current and it's a living map. And he starts to explain some of the symbols that are on this map to Sheriff Truman. He first starts off explaining the fire symbol, how it doesn't mean fire precisely. It's a type of fire and it's more in line with electricity. So it's like energy then, right? Energy and, mm-hmm. and how we harness it and use it.
Yeah.
And Truman asks whether if it's a good or a bad thing. And he says it depends on the intent behind it, how it's wielded. He also points to the stars, showing him how the stars, if you really look at it, is actually aligns with the date that was given or the dates that were given to them from Major Briggs. And then he says that those stars also point down towards this corn. The corn is actually starting to be overtaken with this black discoloration. And where the corn used to mean fertility now means diseased, unnatural death. And then above the corn, there's a symbol of black fire. And if you put together the original symbol of fire that he described and the diseased corn, you get that black fire, which is not good at all.
Mm-hmm.
Truman asks about the symbol above the Twin Peaks, the what we think is the petroglyph symbol or the mother symbol. And he says, Frank, you don't ever want to know about that.
Ever. I promise you. Never, ever, ever.
So one of the things I thought about, and I don't have the exact quote, but it reminded me of what the log lady said to Laura before she went into the roadhouse and fire a walk with me when you're looking at the diseased corn and how it's being overtaken. So she talked about Laura being consumed by fire and how she still had some of herself left, but not completely. And because some of the corn still actually had a little bit of green at the tip, but was mostly turned black. And
it was just that one stalk, I think, on the left side, like the first one. It still had like the green sheets right. at the mm-hmm. at the top of it.
And I was reading a theory online where somebody had, and this is a new take on this symbol, and I like it. Is that the symbol where we've been thinking it's the petroglyph and all that stuff. What if it's actually pointing to that there's a gateway between the actual two peaks of Twin Peaks? Because you've got the black cool. circle like we saw
with the
at the end yeah. of the wormhole. And so if you look at it, it's like two peaks with that black circle in the center.
That's great. I like that mm-hmm. a lot. But then why would a gateway need a parachute? So then it kind of, so then I don't like it. But no, that's actually really insightful. I like that a lot.
So do you guys have any thoughts about the black fire and the disease corn or anything like that?
The disease corn, to me, is just obviously Garmin-Bosia. Mm-hmm. Or that's where Garmin-Bosia comes from.
Yeah, you and I talked about that after watching it, because we were talking about how corn by itself in its natural state is good.
Mm-hmm.
Creamed corn looks like corn in a big puddle of pus.
Yeah, it looks like it's... I like cream corn. I think it tastes good, but it looks like it's been vomited up. It looks like somebody ate regular corn and then decided maybe that wasn't the best idea, and then they puked it up. And
yes, it looks disgusting.
Black fire just sounds like ridiculously dangerous. Like it just, like you would just inhale some of the smoke and get cancer immediately, or mm-hmm. you know, it would burn you and you'd never heal or something like that.
So is that maybe a specific characteristic of this gateway that you can't find in other gateways? And maybe is that why Mr. C wants to get to that, because he wants to utilize that black fire? Well,
it depends on where this gateway takes you. You know what I mean? Like, this could just be the origin of a lot of different things. That's the way I look at it. It's kind of like if you had 30 gateways, this is the gateway. You know, this could either take you to a place where if you wield it, good things can happen, or it'll take you to a place where you wield it and you can make bad things happen. It's kind of almost like the Dark Crystal. Remember that old movie where they have the crystal and when it's whole, they can use it a certain way and the right people use it, it's great. But then when it's broken and the wrong people use it, the land and everything dies. And if you think about it being near Twin Peaks, all the things we had just talked about, how it's kind of oozing out, maybe some of the, either the mother or the woodsman are already kind of there manipulating it, because some of the guards are possibly down, or something's even going on in the lodges that are affecting it, you know? So they're sending, and that's why everybody's converging on it to gain control to save the Twin Peaks and possibly the planet. That's just me, you know? That's how it feels to me, because he says it could either be good, like the fire can be good depending on how it's used.
Yeah, the intention behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not the black fire, though.
No, but it's the mixture of the two. That's what I'm, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's been some people putting forth the idea that the first time we saw Hawk go out into the woods after talking to Margaret, that's actually in the future. So what if he's the last man standing after everybody trying to get to this gateway, which is actually around the sycamore trees, and that's actually correct?
Why would there be two gateways in Twin Peaks?
Well, one goes to the lodge, which is the sycamore tree. So this would be a completely different location that they're trying to get to then, that's not related to the lodge.
Okay.
Why would Mr. C want to go to the lodge when he was trying to prevent himself from like getting pulled back into it, right?
Yeah, Andy knows where the lodge is. He can go back there, I'm sure, if he wanted to, right? He walked out.
Right. Yeah. So there, I guess what I'm getting at, though, is what is it about Twin Peaks that makes it such a convergence of all this stuff? Not only do you have the coordinates for wherever this place takes you, but you also can get to the lodge over here, too. This is just like one-stop shopping for everything bad.
I think we're going to find out. I think we're going to find all this out. Because, I mean, we have so much not explained, you know, like maybe it's just the altitude. Who knows? I mean, it could be, I don't know, you know, maybe a flying saucer landed there. I don't know. I mean,
I've got one more time thing to throw out there that I read about. Some people are of the thinking that the kid has not yet been ran over yet, and that's why the police department isn't moving towards that just yet. In fact, that's going to happen about 10 days after this event.
Why would Richard Horne go through all of that he did in the previous part to go to then just come back to Twin Peaks in 10 days, be all nonchalant with a meeting with Red, and then get all riled up and go do that?
Because all that's in the future.
All that's in the future.
So they're saying this scene was in the past.
Yeah.
Whew, that's painful.
That doesn't make any sense, though, because everything that he does, the whole hitting the kid was the impetus for this. So if this is already in the past, how can him hitting the kid be in the future?
That everything else is running on the same time, but this is like a preview, you know what I'm saying, and that all this was in the future.
Oh, okay.
I just don't see why you would have that. It's possible, but good Lord. Oof, still painful.
I'm not fully sold. Like, some of these things are tantalizing, but I'm not yet fully sold on any, not even like all the way 100% on any of the theories I've heard about the time travel stuff, because they start with a little bit of like, ooh, wouldn't that be cool if, but then there's nothing to, there's no guts, there's nothing to back them up kind of thing. We have to wait until we're shown more information before any of that could be verified or really negated. But I'm on board to see what's going to happen because I don't buy into that kind of stuff. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm the eternal skeptic on that. But
people are trying to explain why the sheriff's department and Andy specifically are not following up on this case. Why there's no more talk about it.
Well, we don't know for sure that they're not following up. All we're seeing of the police department is them putting together clues with Hawk. We don't know what the rest of the police department's working on. We haven't even hardly seen Andy except for 3 minutes when they buy chairs together. So there could technically be more going on. I just think with everything else that's going on that it's just kind of a footnote. Like, I wouldn't want them wasting time on finding who the killer is. Eventually, that's going to come out. Because that woman crawled out of the woods. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that they're kind of like not showing us that. I think it's like a choice of we have 7 episodes left. What are we going to put on there? The investigation, or are we going to put on Dougie Coop and this scene and everything else? You know, so I can see why they did it, and I'm not going to fret over it. You know, it's like, I'm glad we know who did it.
We had kind of brainstormed about, that maybe being an object lesson in how Twin Peaks has kind of come into the rest of the world and its callousness and indifference mm-hmm. towards human suffering and things like that. Going forward with that motif, maybe there just won't be a follow-up on this. Maybe there's no jangly time kind of stuff that's going on. Maybe this is just an unfortunate thing that happened, and it gives us insight into the character of Twin Peaks as a character in the show and how Richard Horn is, and that's mm-hmm. all it was there to do, you know.
Well, I think we're going to get justice, because otherwise why would she have lived and crawled out of the woods?
Not for her necessarily, but okay, I see what you're saying.
For the child, that's what I mean, like the storyline isn't dead yet.
No,
it's just like you said, look at everything else that's going on in Twin Peaks.
Right,
he's not busting someone that he knows is selling drugs. Bobby isn't, you know, his daughter's husband. We see continuous violence going on. Horn's beating up his grandmother and stealing. And this is happening in the streets on like a Friday night, it looks like. You know, kids are just shooting guns out the window. I mean, it's what I was saying about everything just kind of like all this bad is happening consistently. Maybe the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department just has its hands full.
I can buy that's
under investigation.
I can buy that easier than I can heretofore unexplained mm-hmm. time loops and warps and jumps and things like that. Even though those theories are fun to think about for a second or two, I put more faith in what we're saying now.
And they're so busy, they sent Andy to do a follow-up. I mean, that's...
What if on October 1st and October 2nd, what if he's all that's left, or very few that's left after everybody went to, you know, the Bookhouse Boys and...
Oh my God, that would be crazy. It's totally possible. I'm not... Trust me, I've known better than to go, oh, that's not possible. They'd never do that, because they'll do it. So if it unfolds that way... I just hope they explain it, and it's not just kind of like, wait, what just happened? Is it, cause I know they say it at the beginning, and they do that on purpose. Is it now or is it then? So
exactly.
This whole time that's going to be put out there, but that could just be like the IMDb thing where they're like trying to make you think, trying to make sure that you're paying attention. And it's possible. I mean, we don't even know if Dougie Coop and all that's happening at the same time. I mean, if we go on, there's just so many possibilities. It's fantastic. And at the same time, it's a little stressful.
Honestly, the more I think about it, the more it appeals to me.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since you brought up how Mike said, is it past or is it present? I think that's an important thing we need to keep telling ourselves and asking ourselves as we're watching this show. I don't necessarily need to believe that it's shifting time as far as like as it's actually happening within Twin Peaks and South Dakota and Las Vegas. I just think that's how the story is being told to me in various times. So just like Pulp Fiction was.
Exactly. That's a great way to look at it.
And that's an interesting way to tell a story where you show the crisis point but you don't show its resolution yet or exactly how you got there. that is being told to you as you move along.
Pretty cool stuff. I mean, I can't wait. I don't want it to end, but I can't wait till it's all over to see the full painting. You know, I feel like we're being shown a painting as it's being painted. I can't wait to see the whole thing. And hopefully I sit back and stare at it for a while and try and figure it out even more, because I know I'm not going to get it all. But I can't wait to see it all done.
And speaking of time stuff, because we were just alluding to this earlier, as you know, Truman and Hawk are in this room, we've got Deputy Jesse who comes in, and it's like the shooting didn't happen out in the street, that he was just there. Now, it could be that this is a different time. This is happening earlier to the date of Bobby and the shooting kid outside of the Double R, or it could be that this is just showing the mundanity of crime within the sheriff's department, to where this is probably what happens. You deal with an event like that, but at the end of the day, you're still going, hey, man, can I show you my car?
And it's, there's a, everybody's speculating on, you know, speaking of time, what year this is actually taking place in. And Jesse is about to say what year his car is. He says, ooh, it's a 2000, point. And then he gets
crap.
Cut off.
See?
He gets cut off with that. Now, that wouldn't let us know any kind of linear thing about the time weaving in and out of what events happened first, but it would let you know at the very least what year that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Or what year it could possibly be, because if he says my car is, it's a 2016, blah, 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 then there you go. Or if he says 2017, which he probably wouldn't, because they're going to keep it at the very least tied to the year they filmed it in. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, that right there, I'm landing firmly now on the fact that time is shifty.
Shifty bastards.
Yeah.
Well, if all of these times are like cards in a magic trick, I'm ready for that final approach where we start to tie everything all together, because I feel like we're getting, as we get, if this is what's happening, there's a little bit of frustration, at least on my part, because rather than get tighter, we're getting looser and expanding it out. The closer we get to the end, the more unanswered questions we throw out there. And I know this is Lynch, and we're not going to get all the questions answered, but I want to see a nice, nifty magic trick at the end of it, not 52-card pickup. You see what I'm saying? So
oh, I agree.
I don't feel confident that that's what I'm looking at.
Really?
Yeah, because I feel like whenever shows do this, Lynch has no problem leaving us hanging. We know that. You know what I mean? So at the end of it, I'm not saying he's going to, but there's a very, very real fear that there's a lot of, especially as we get closer, that there's a lot of questions that won't be answered because we've made zero or very little progress towards answering them. And then instead of making that progress, we go down different roads to get more questions. And then you throw in the loopiness of time and when did this happen and how, and it just becomes more and more and more complicated, which if it's all drawn together, right, could just be a beautiful mosaic of storytelling. But if it's not, just say it.
I think it's going to be a beautiful magic trick, and I can't wait.
I'm hoping. I have both fingers crossed. I'm really hoping that's what I want to be. But, you know,
I can wait. I'm going to say that because I'm actually like, oh, there's only seven left. But seven is actually a good amount of time to actually make a magic trick possible. So
you're absolutely right. But it has to start. And, you know, I think we get a little bit. I'm very hopeful. I'm made very hopeful by the very last scene of this episode, because I feel like something happened there. So we'll get into it when we get there. But that's all I had to say about that.
Okay. Lucy beeps in to tell Hawk that Margaret Lanterman's on line two. And Margaret says she knows that he has found something. He can't tell her what he has found. She tells him that there is fire where he is going. And we already mentioned the knock at the door, and that's the deputy who wants to show him his 2000 and something car. And now we're back with the FBI agents and Diane, and Gordon's hand is shaking, much like a lot of people's hands were shaking at the end of season two of Twin Peaks. Albert thinks that coffee's not a great idea, and yet he gets coffee anyway because it's brought in by Tammy. But before they come in, Gordon wants to see the pic of Ruth because he mishears Albert, which prompts him to ask about Ruth. So Albert pulls out the picture of her arm, and Diane is not hiding the fact that she's trying to memorize those numbers.
Yeah, I mean, it's like pretty blatant.
Yes. She's just like mouthing them, you know, as she's like 8, 5.
And Albert eyes her pointedly, and she sees this. She asks if she can smoke inside the room. So it seems like she would normally just get up and leave and smoke, because she's actually recused herself or not gone with him to smoke. But
I don't think she wants to be outside alone smoking a cigarette with all the shenanigans that are going on, especially around that area.
Well, that, and she doesn't want to miss anything that they're talking about either.
Yeah, that's true, too. That's probably more likely it. She wants to
because
get it.
I'm hoping she wants to do all this so she can get there and take Mr. C out herself, right? That's all. That's all. She's not bad. She wants to kill Mr. C. It's my last-ditch hope to keep Diane on the bright side, not the dark side.
So she'll just be, like, moralistically...
neutral?
Neutral until she gets that chance. Just like, well, Hastings about to bite it. No problem.
I hope so.
I did notice that in the last scene, at the very end of it, Hawk looks down after he's talking with Margaret, and it looks like he's looking at his own hand, but it turns out to be Cole's hand that's shaking.
Oh, that's a good point.
And it's shaking like a cat on a hot tin roof.
So that's a cool transition scene, nice transition scene that you're describing. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, I thought it was neat because at first I was like, that's Hawk is looking at his own hand. And then you hear Gordon Cole's voice. He's like,
that's the thing about this show, because we cover a lot of television series and you can watch the show 3 times, 4 times, and you still don't catch everything.
Right.
Unlike the other shows we cover. I mean, you could watch them twice and feel pretty confident you caught 98%.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you feel like you're trying to catch stuff that's actually not there in certain shows, because when you watch a show like this where there's so much to catch, you watch another show and you're just like, all right, what am I not seeing? And then you just have to come to that realization sometimes it's not there. This isn't, you know, Lynch and Frost. So
Albert's saying how the coordinates, that the last few numbers of the coordinates were smudged, but the numbers indicate a town in the north, and we're cut off here, just like we were with Jesse's date of his car, as Tammy enters with Detective Mackley, and they've got coffee and donuts, or danishes or something. We can assume it's the northwest.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is.
But what if it's the northeast in New York, where the glass box is? Could be.
It could just as well be, but we're not going to know because it cut it off.
And what if the glass box is about just creating that gateway out of whole cloth without using an atom bomb, possibly?
That's a cool idea. Put your hand in the box.
Or has somehow captured and, like, reduced a gateway with inside the box somehow, or I don't know. Okay, so Diane's really insistent on being able to smoke inside the room, and Detective Mackley allows her to do so after she puts her case forward.
He's still pretty shaken up about Hastings.
I mean, do you think there's anything having to do with God of Light and fire and Diane and the need for her to be in the room? Is there some way that – is she transmitting information somehow with the fire and her cigarette? I know that sounds so crazy. But I'm just wondering.
It makes sense.
I'm just wondering if there's something to that. And then you have to wonder about her intent behind her flame.
Like the woodsman can live in her cigarette and send messages. I wouldn't put it past him. I wouldn't put it past him. You know, like every now and then she takes a drag and you know how you get that little dark ash on the end of a cigarette? They poke their head out. With their ear poked out. Like, what? All right. And then send it. I wouldn't put it past him. Who knows?
Burnt tobacco is just woodsman's ears, after all. So
I mean, Mr. C has a tape recorder that hacks the internet. So, I mean, who knows what's going on with the... I mean, his network is pretty impressive.
I think Diane's just got a forceful personality. She's indignant about being drug along for this trip. Mm-hmm. And when she wants to smoke, goddammit, she should be able to smoke. She couldn't smoke in a morgue and everybody was pansies because of it, you know? She can't smoke in this police building because what? Because you're not allowed to, because it's the rules.
25 years ago, you could.
Yeah, probably less than that, really. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know when they started. But anyway, you know, Mackley capitulates and he's like, all right, smoke them if you got them.
Well, maybe that's why she insisted on smoking inside the morgue, because it was somehow provided some sort of connection.
I mean, it's totally possible. I would... If it comes out that they're sending messages through cigarettes, I'm going to look at cigarettes differently.
If that's the case, why would you need the cell phones?
I don't know. I'm not saying I like that idea. I just wondering about her persistence of smoking indoors, and especially around these specific events that are very integral to everything that's going on. And I'm not saying it's an elegant idea. I'm just wondering about it.
I honestly think that she just wants to get as much information as she can. That's why after when everybody – because you figure in the morgue, everybody was leaving and she wanted to smoke. So she's already going to be alone anyway. And then they give her shit and she's like, fuck you, everyone's dead here anyway. But then she goes outside later, probably just to get a minute to send another message or do whatever. But then Gordon and them come out. So in this instance, I think she's just definitely in there like, I'm not going to miss anything. And then y'all aren't going to tell me because you know the reaction I'm going to give you if you say no. I'm going to do it anyway.
I think there's commentary running through this whole The Return on the insistence of people to do things that they know hurt them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That they I'll rephrase that. There's a theme that's running through The Return that revolves around the insistence on some individuals to keep doing habits that are detrimental to them, their health, and to the health of other people. And I don't know if that's commentary on the human condition, but it does seem to revolve around smoking. Carl Rod has it when he's talking about how he smoked cigarettes every day for 75 years or however long it was, and I'm doing fine. You know, the guy's probably got stage 5 cancer and doesn't know it. And then you've got this earlier in this very scene that we're talking about now, Albert says, but smoking's bad for you. I know. Fuck you, Albert.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure where it's going with that. I know David Lynch has been a avid smoker in the past, so maybe there's some commentary there. I'm just trying to connect some disparate dots right here.
He's like, I'll smoke where I want to smoke now.
Yeah.
So now they're talking about the woodsman, and Diane admits that she saw one, but she says she saw it leaving the car, but then she also says she's not sure. So it could be her memory's faulty. It's not like Bill Hastings' memory's been great about his experience around that particular area. Yeah.
Or it could be a ploy also. Like, well, why didn't you see anything? And it's like, well, kind of, but not really. So they kind of don't think that she's going to pay attention or answer questions. When you think she worked all those years with Agent Cooper hand in hand, that she's, I mean, she's pretty formidable in her own right. So I think it's kind of her throwing that out there. Like, yeah, I saw something, but not really. I think just to kind of get them to look another direction, even though they're not going to because they're on to her.
Well, she's attempting to memorize that series of coordinates, so she must have that capability for her to even try to do so in the first place. So she has practiced memory. But there could be something about the effect of seeing those woodsmen that messes with your memory a little bit. And I think I'm just saying that because I want to believe that, because I want to have doubt in her evilness. But again, I keep seeing her watch that woodsman crouch its way towards the car and not do anything.
I believe in Diane.
Oh, my belief is shaken, sadly.
I understand.
Okay, are we done with this scene?
Yeah,
I think so.
All right, so now we're with Dougie finally. We got Bushnell. Bushnell has summoned Dougie via Phil, and it's funny because I think after all these days, Phil has figured out how to finally get Dougie into the building without having to deal with elevator doors and all that crap, just by like leading him by coffee. Get him to the point where he needs to be, then give him the coffee.
He's smart.
Whatever works.
Mm-hmm. Dangle that carrot.
And so as Phil brings Dougie into Bushnell's office. Anthony Sinclair peeks through the window, and that's just to remind us of everything that's going on with the Mitchum brothers. Bushnell tells Dougie that his investigation has uncovered organized crime and possible police corruption. And he also says that the Mitchum brothers are not part of this conspiracy and that they actually had legitimate fire. It wasn't arson, which mm-hmm. we had I think speculated that they actually caused the fire, Duncan Todd, and then prevented them from collecting the $30 million. So it sounds like it was actual accidental fire.
Yeah, Duncan Todd and them just wrote the wrong report up. So interesting.
It was Duncan Todd and his minions via the Lucky 7 insurance agency were able to keep the Mitchum brothers from getting their insurance relief, as it's called.
Well, did it involve the detectives Fusco in any way?
Oh, I have
because he says knows? Police corruption.
Hmm.
I don't know if it would though, because those guys seem to be fairly on the up and up, right?
There were detective names on those pieces of paper, but I don't remember who they were specifically. So I'd have to go back and look. So that's why he's referring to police corruption, because you did have to have these detectives sign off on it.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
So Bushnell tells Dougie that the Mitchum brothers have requested a meeting and that Dougie will deliver the $30 million check to them. And Bushnell is explaining how he's insured the insurance company against such a payout. As Cooper is letting him know that he is taking in this information, he understands. He's doing these what I call cat kisses, which I think is just adorable. And this is where Bushnell's telling him that they're sending a car for him and all that stuff.
I honestly thought that Bushwick Bill was setting him up at this point.
Right.
I thought he was just for a second. It faded after a while, but I thought he was kind of setting him up and being like, okay, well, we're going to send you to go do this and you're going to go bye-bye. I don't know why that, you know, what he would have to get out of that, but it just felt like that for a second. I was like, these guys want to kill him and you're sending Dougie right into the dragon's lair.
No, I get a just complete good feeling from Bushnell. Like, just he's doing push-ups in his room.
Well, almost just too good of a feeling, though. Just no. Yeah, like he's naive. Like, okay, this guy's wife just took him to the hospital to get checked out, or his doctor, his GP, and he barely, I don't think he's formed a sentence in 3-4 days in the show's time, and you're going to send him to known gangsters with a check in your pocket and hope that he conveys apology and gives them their money. Now, granted, Dougie's a master at this, but it felt like not intentional, but kind of like not just being naive of, okay, he'll be able to handle it. I mean, you just watched somebody lead him into the office with coffee.
So looking at this as a good thing, you know, with Bushnell being a good guy and everything, it kind of almost feels like a cool mirror of the relationship between Dale Cooper and Gordon Cole, with Gordon Cole being Bushnell Mills Dale Cooper being Dougie. Like, I know you can handle this, champ. I'm going to send you out there to go do the Lord's work.
Yeah, that's a really cool analogy.
So only Bushnell can hear better.
Thank God.
So now we're at the Mitchum Brothers apartment and they're having a very late breakfast. It's like 2:23 in the afternoon. Rodney still has his eye wound at this point. So just 3 hours from now, it's going to be completely gone.
His candy cut.
Candy is actually pouring coffee. At least I'm assuming it's Candy. Bradley comes out and sits down and he reports how he had a dream about killing Dougie Jones. And now we're back with Dougie and he's being walked by Bushnell to go meet the car that's to take him to meet the Mitchum brothers. But Dougie spies off to the side Mike within the lodge setting within a coffee shop. It's actually Simon's Famous Coffees. And it's spelt S-Z-Y-M-O-N-S, apostrophe S, and that's actually the Polish way of spelling Simon.
Cool.
The O is a pie that looks like it's got a rays like a sun. When I first saw it, I actually thought of the Laura orb. And then the Z is, remind me think of the Z that we've seen on coffee cups before in New York, but.
So they could be a chain. They could be a nationwide chain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the Z is bold, where the rest of the lettering is not. So now Bushnell, Dougie, and Dougie holding a giant box are now walking to the limo. It's the same limo driver that took Dougie home previously, and he recognizes Dougie. He helps Dougie into the limo, which is a funny moment.
His eyes get all just super wide when he's pushing his head down. He's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, as the limo driver is helping Dougie into the car, I don't think Dougie was prepared for that downward motion of his body and his eyes just go wide, which is funny. But before Dougie gets in the car, though, Bushnell says, knock him dead, champ. And Dougie touches his face and holds it and he says, dead. That worries me.
Right. So, it was very ominous for sure.
Well, because you don't have him just repeating. He's actually holding his face.
Mm-hmm.
He's recalling something. It's like some sort of trigger word that's coming back to him for some reason.
I think it's meant to make us nervous before he goes on this trip, because we already understand the intent of the Mitchum brothers. So, but I don't know if anybody thought Dougie was going to die in this episode.
No, but he could have been maimed.
Yeah, he could have been hurt. Yeah.
You know, mobsters have a way of like using pliers and blowtorches and stuff like that. It was possible.
So now Dougie is riding in the limo with the limo driver. That's obvious. Okay. Dougie's riding the limo and Viva Las Vegas is playing. And we see Excalibur Casino, among other casinos. And I noted Excalibur because there's been a lot of allusions to the King Arthur tales and other areas of Twin Peaks, specifically Glastonbury Grove. And the limo arrives into this desert area that have a lot of ruins. And Bradley and Ronnie are waiting in their car. And Bradley's trying to talk them out of killing Dougie because he just has a bad feeling because of the dream he had. And he is looking at Ronnie and he remembers about the candy cut being healed. And he pulls off his Band-Aid and lo and behold, it's true. His cut has miraculously healed. Dougie arrives. Bradley is now triggered by the box that Dougie is carrying to recall another aspect of his dream. And he whispers this to Ronnie. And Ronnie's like, okay, what the fuck in the box there? Is that a cherry
What's
pie?
What's in the box?
But he grabs his gun first. That's such a great moment. Actually, from this point on till the very end of this episode is probably my all-time favorite Twin Peaks scene of this season. So good. And so Dougie repeats, yes, cherry. He says, cherry pie. And so Bradley walks over, peeks in, and it's a cherry pie. And Bradley gets really excited about it. And he frisks Cooper. And Cooper has no wallet, but he finds the $30 million check. And now he's exhilarated. And it's just a funny moment. And
it's pretty awesome. I mean, there's not much to say about it because it's Dougie's just standing there like holding this box and they pretty much take care of the whole thing. And in Dougie's fashion, everything is resolved and he doesn't really do anything.
No, he doesn't.
Once again, repeating words back to people works magic for him. You know, and right? He doesn't even really, he's just parroting back, you know, cherry pie.
So they love him like we love him now. And so now they're at, I guess, what is Santino's, where they had lied to Bushnell and said they were taking him to?
Yeah. That's the restaurant that supposedly he was going to. He's really just going to be taken out to the desert to be shot.
And they're actually talking about whether or not Sonny Jim has a gym set.
Yeah.
And then you find out they grew up in an orphanage because they even said, I think it's Rodney says, well, even our orphanage had a gym set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is interesting because that I thought about how Bradley said last episode talking about Candy. He's like, can't fire. She has no place to go.
So maybe they're orphans?
Or, I mean, just having that sense of not having a place to go.
Yeah.
They empathize with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's their weak spot. Interesting. So you know, Sonny Jim's about to get a banging freaking play set, though.
Oh, man. Yeah. That thing's going to be like what you see at schoolyards, you know? Like the multicolored slide and the swings.
It might look like a pirate ship. Who knows? Who
Monkey
knows?
Bar,
you
yeah.
got two mobsters that just got $30 million about to buy you a gift. Sweet.
And they're overlooking the $442,000 that you took from the casino.
Hey, it's all right.
Hey, that's the flip side of fortune. If you're going to give me $30 million, you can keep that $440,000, whatever. Yeah, I'm good.
Champagne's poured and cheery music takes a somber note. And at first it made me think of the Laura Palmer's theme, but it's actually called Heartbreaking and is written by Angela Badalamenti. It captures Dougie's attention. Right at the same point, the woman from the casino thanks Mr. Jackpots for changing her life. And all kinds of great things have come into her life since then. Her son is now back. His name is Denver. She's got a dog and she's got a house and she's dressed all glitzy. And she's very happy and grateful. And she tells Rodney and Bradley what a special person this is. And she hopes they know that.
And yeah, because she's like, she saved my life. And they're like, he saved us money.
That's more important, lady. That's more important. Yeah.
So she departs, and now the pie arrives, as does Candy and Mandy and Sandy. And I think it's Rodney says, Candy, where have you been? And it takes her a moment to check into reality. And she says, the traffic on the strip, and talks about how there was just so many cars. Like, it was such an amazing thing. And they're doing a toast with the champagne and declaring each other friends. And they start to eat pie and damn good pie is said. And Dougie's...
Damn good.
Yes. And Dougie's really forking it into his mouth and Bradley notices. So he gestures towards Candy to give him more pie. And he has to emphasize once again, Candy. And I love Candy. so much.
Yeah, she's a little annoying to me, but no. I did notice the demeanor of them and Dougie next to each other. Dougie could just stand up and stand there with them, and they would be a match set. You know, like he'd fit right in with Candy and the girls, you know? So maybe they're replacements too.
Dougie-itis. You know,
because of the way they act, yeah.
I don't know what it is, but every time I watch it, I crack up. And it's like this different kind of sense of humor that I didn't know existed. Like David Lynch and Mark Frost found this different like nook or cranny to mine mm-hmm. for some unusual type of humor that I'd never encountered before.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
But Candy, you know, steps two and she's happily giving Dougie more pie.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the cheerful music that's playing and everything just seems like all happy. And then the music then drops down to the somber notes.
So I'm thinking that this is when Cooper woke up. When he got that first mouthful of pie and he chewed it up and he swallowed it. You can mm-hmm. see this look on his face when when one of the Mitchum brothers says, "Damn good pie," and he's like, "Yeah," and he agrees with him. I think they do a zoom in, not a zoom in, but kind of like a closer shot. I guess not necessarily a close up, but a closer shot, and you can see there's a light in his eyes that hasn't been there before, and then his eyes start to move around normally like a regular person's instead of being the catatonic Dougie where it's just staring off into one direction and kind of maybe, you know, moving over a little bit. Because it almost seemed like he wouldn't really shift his eyes as much as he would move his head to look at mm-hmm. something else, you know. And I think the light came on and then he realized it all came back to him. And then he realized what was going on and he had the memory of being Dougie and he realized what kind of situation he was in. And so he just played the part from then on out. But I think he is Cooper now because you can see it. I feel like you can see it in his eyes that it's there now.
I hope so. Please let Cooper come back. Don't give us one episode with Agent Cooper. Give us like five at least.
Yeah.
The rest of them should be that. The rest of them should be with Agent Cooper.
Yes.
So we'll see. Steve's getting pretty impatient. I think that's evident.
I think everybody is, right? A little bit?
I'm not.
I am. I can't lie. I'm ready to see some Agent Cooper.
Yeah. I mean, I'm ready to see him, but I'm not impatient for it. I still have a lot of trust and faith that everything's mm-hmm. going to be fine.
I'm just ready to see Agent Cooper in action in this new scenery. You know, it's like we got him in a few episodes and then it's Dougie, which is cool. Dougie's that kind of friend though. It's like, you know, he's kind of cool to hang out with sometimes, but Cooper's real cool to hang out with.
Yeah. I would rather hang out with Cooper. I guess that's all I'm saying.
Well, you know, so if Diane was successful at memorizing those coordinates, and if she is connected to Mr. C, that means Mr. C is going to get those coordinates soon, and everybody's going to be ending up in the same place.
Oh, yeah.
FBI. Except for
Dougie. He'll be back in Las Vegas.
Yeah, and if it's the Northwest that everybody's heading to, hopefully it is, and not the Northeast, then that means FBI is going to be showing up there as well as Mr. C. What about Dougie, though? Who's going to get him there?
I think Mr. C's on his way to Vegas.
And we still can't forget that the Detectives Fusco are going to be running Dougie's prints through a database.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dougie's prints. And then Mr. C sent the two goons to Vegas to take care of it if this guy doesn't. So we know the two goons are coming. And you know they're going to fail. So then Mr. C will have to go. Or Coop will snap out of it when... I keep calling the two goons because I can't remember their names.
You're talking about Hutch and...
Yes. Because he tells them, you need to go to Vegas and handle this.
He does say Vegas. I know they're supposed to go kill the warden.
Yeah, well, after the warden, I'm pretty sure he said you have to go to Vegas and handle this if so-and-so doesn't do it. Right?
He told Duncan Todd to take care of it. Mm-hmm. He said, next time I talk to you, make sure it's taken care of.
Yeah, and that's why.
I could have swore at the farm he mentions it, though.
He might have.
He might have, but I know that's why like Anthony Sinclair was dispatched by Duncan because
oh for sure
Ike the Spike he just saw Ike this or it was confirmed by Roger that Ike the Spike has been arrested, so that's why he was like, Anthony, come in here, and then
oh absolutely
that was his next like way to throw mm-hmm. something at Dougie, and now that just failed. So, because now the Mitchum brothers are friendly with Dougie, mm-hmm. so.
They might even go so far as to protect him.
Oh, for sure. They're boys now.
Yeah, and Candy's going to figure into this somehow. So now that Dougie is linked to the Mitchum brothers and, you know, I don't think that Candy is just some throwaway character or even comic relief. There's more to her, and there's probably something to her behavior that, being that it's similar to Dougie, maybe there's some sort of similar affliction.
She's the giant. She's like the old man, you know? She's the giant down to keep an eye on Dougie because he made him.
I mean, maybe it's like the inverse of a body with a host. What if there's like a body without the full on like fire or soul on the inside or something? Yeah. You know, it's the inverse of what happened in the original series of these things that are of the lodge.
I mean, it's possible for sure.
I don't know.
All right, well, that's enough of that for now. We'll bounce some more ideas on our feedback podcast, especially with whatever you guys decide to bring and throw at us. Once again, that will be recorded this Thursday. Please have your email in at noshipnetwork@gmail.com by 6:00 Eastern Standard Time. And all right, that's it for this podcast. We will talk to you then. Thank you. Good night. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Damn good. I don't have anything. I couldn't think of anything that stood out.
You'd be like, I was just kidding. Don't do that.
God, I don't think I could do it.
Just gunshots.
Pew, 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 pew.